Any new novel by a writer as esteemed as the Indian Bengali master Amitav Ghosh is good news for serious readers. The announcement that his latest, Sea of Poppies, is meant to be the first volume of a new trilogy was cause for real celebration. Born in India and educated in Delhi and at Oxford University, Ghosh has written several prize-winning novels, as well as works of nonfiction and essays. In Sea of Poppies, he delights in exploring the rich linguistic heritage of the British Raj on the surrounding Asian cultures. When we talked, Amitav Ghosh read a passage from his book in which we eavesdrop on some salty sailor stories.
In the old days, the rascally Babaji Khana was the best in the city. No fear of pish-pash and cobbly-mash at the rascally table. The dumpokes and palaus were good enough, but we old hands, we'd wait for the curry of cock-up and the chichki of pollock-sog. Oh, he set a rankin' table, I can tell you. And mind you, supper was just the start. The real tamasha came later in the notch corner. Now there was another chakmak sight for you. Rows of kursis for the sahibs and mems to sit on, sitringis and takias for the natives, the babus puffing at their hubble bubbles and the sahibs lighting their Sumatra bunkuses, kanchanis whirling and tikito boys beating their tablas. Oh, that old lucha knew how to put on a notch all right. He was a sly little shaitan too, the rascally Roger. If he saw you eyeing one of the putlis, he'd send around a kitmatgar, bowing and bobbing and the picture of innocence. People would think you'd eaten one too many jalebis and needed to be shown to the cacatorium. But instead of the totti corner, off you'd go to a little hidden kamra there to pakrao your dashi. Not a memsahib present any the wiser, and there you were with your gobbler in a kanchani's nether whiskers, getting yourself a nice little taste of a blackberry bush. He breathed a nostalgic sigh. Oh, they were grand old golmals, those rascally barakhanas. No better place to get your tatters tickled.
I have a strong feeling that I'd better not ask you what some of those sentences meant.
Probably not. But, you know, what I should explain to you is that it's true that you probably haven't come across these words before. But in fact, the great majority of the words, even in this passage, are actually in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Are they really?
Yes, Babaji Khana, pish-pash, cobbly-mash, dumpok, palau, cock-up is there as well, which is the kind of fish. Chichki of pollock-sog isn't there, but it's in another very well-known English dictionary, as is Rankin. Tamasha has been in the English language since the 18th century, since the 17th century, as has Notch Khana. Chakmak is there in many dictionaries. So all of these bunkus, Sumatra bunkus, it's a cigar.
Well, now, they may all be in the Oxford English Dictionary, but I'm curious, how many of them did you know before you began the idea of this novel?
I knew a lot of them because, you know, I have a sort of interest, not just in language, but in, you know, in the meeting place between languages. This whole sort of area of where languages meet and shade into each other is something very, very interesting to me. And, you know, just looking at 19th century dictionaries, and I love to read dictionaries, you know, it's one of my passions. When you start reading 19th century dictionaries, one thing that you do discover is that English in the 19th century was much, much more international than it is today, you know. It's one of those sort of curious paradoxes. People seem to think that, you know, with globalization, the English language has grown sort of more and more inclusive. This is far from being the case. I think what actually happened is that in the 20th century, once the dominance of English was established, it actually became much narrower and it started to rid itself of many kinds of influences, especially of Asian influences. But in the 19th century, English was much, much more accepting.
It's funny, isn't it? Because we think of it as a polyglot language that accepts words from other languages. And we hear from year after year that the French, for instance, established the panel to try to keep the language pure. And the English have never done that. But it seems you're suggesting to have happened on its own.
Yes, I do think that actually did happen. And one of the processes by which it may have happened is paradoxically through this dictionarization process. But I feel quite persuaded that within the 20th century, and especially in the late 20th century, English did go through unconsciously this kind of purification process. You might even call it a whitening process, really, where African and Asian influences were marginalized. Actually, so much Asian influence has been internalized in English. That's another curious thing that, say, you know, especially in, say, textile names, for example. I mean, say, dungarees, that sounds so American, doesn't it? But the word dungaree comes from a fort in Bombay, you know, where these cotton goods were produced.
It sounds as though you're suggesting that the English spoken in India, in Asia, may in fact be a richer kind of English than the English spoken in Boston or San Francisco.
Yes, I do think that's true. I mean, I do think that in India, certainly we take much greater liberties with the language. We are, in that sense, much more, we experiment a lot with the language as such. And we experiment much more with the sort of interfaces of the language.
When you began writing this, though, did you find that even in India there was a kind of difference between the Victorian, early Victorian language of the time that you're writing about and modern Indian English?
Yes, yes. And in fact, that's exactly what started me off along this trail, you know, because many years ago, I was faced with this problem that, you know, if you're writing about India, inevitably a certain number of words, Indian words, creep in. So then I thought, well, I should italicize some of these words to make sure that people know that they're sort of Indian words. And then I thought, what should be the rule by which I italicize them? And then I thought, well, maybe I should italicize the words, you know, which are clearly not English. But then when I started looking at the dictionaries, especially at the Oxford English Dictionary, you suddenly find that it's impossible. So how do you establish that rule? You know, how do you establish the rule by which you push certain words to the margins?
I'm curious, is there the same kind of marginalization, but with a different flavor within India? I mean, one of the other things that comes out in Sea of Poppies is the Lascar dialect, which I suspect might have more of a caste difference, a class difference than some of the other languages. Is that less likely to make its way into the standard dialect spoken in India?
The Lascar language, Laskari, as it came to be described, was really a kind of Indian Ocean nautical language, you know. And it's an extraordinary kind of language because it includes elements of Portuguese, English, Chinese, Malay, Bengali, Hindustani. It's this wonderful sort of mishmash of languages. At the same time, it was really the chief conduit. I'm personally persuaded of this, and I've written about it, that it was the chief conduit for introducing Western words, concepts, ideas into Indian languages. So, yes, I mean, this was a language that would have been spoken by fairly marginal people within Indian society. Yet, these people were also pioneers. They were the first Indians who were working very closely with Westerners. They were the first Indians to really achieve fluency in colloquial Western languages. They were the first Indians to set up settlements in the West, in London, and so on. And in that sense, they were really the advance guard of today's IT professionals, you know. I really see them as pioneers. And they've introduced such a rich array of Western words and concepts into Indian languages. You know, so many of their words are now so much a part of Indian languages that people don't think of them as foreign words. For example, there's the word mistri, you know, which in India everybody uses, and it just means workman. It came into Indian languages from Portuguese, and it comes from the same root as maestro, you know, meaning someone who's a skilled artisan. And through that route, it enters the Indian languages.
It does make sense, doesn't it, for the seagoers to take languages from one place to another. And sometimes that's the most beautiful kind of language as well. We were talking about another section of your book, and perhaps you could read from later on the section that talks about the ships.
Yes. Once the pilot was gone, it remained only to refresh a few supplies before weighing anchor and standing out to sea. The reprovisioning was quickly done, for the schooner was soon besieged by a flotilla of bumboats, cabbage-carrying coracles, fruit-laden dhonis, and machwas that were filled with goats, chickens, and ducks. In this floating bazaar, there was everything a ship or a Lascar might need. Canvas by the gudge, spare jugbulaks and zamburas, coils of istingis and rupian, stacks of sital patti mats, tobacco by the butti, rolls of neem twigs for the teeth, martabans of isabgol for constipation, and jars of Colombo root for dysentery. One ungainly godowa even had a chula going with a halwai frying up fresh jalebis. With so many vendors to set against each other, it took Stuart Pinto and the mess boys very little time to acquire everything that was needed by way of provisions.
It is astonishing in some ways to me to listen to that, and there are clearly words that I don't know and would have to look up, perhaps in the glossary that you provided at the back. I don't know whether they're there. But it bothers me not at all. The sense of it is clear, and you don't need to know what a gudge is to know that that's a lot of canvas.
Gudge is a yard, and that's in the Oxford English Dictionary. It's the Indian word for yard. But a jagbulak is laskari for jack block, which is a kind of wooden object that you have on ships. But it's a very good example, you know, because let's face it, you know, the people who read Melville, for example, and the nautical language that Melville uses, I don't think you'd find over 1 in 1,000 Americans who would understand that nautical language today, because the language of the sail ship was very, very specialized. So say, if you went out into even into a university and asked 1,000 kids, who knows what, a dolphin striker is, I don't think anybody would know, you know.
But you could make a guess.
You could. What would you guess?
Well, a dolphin striker doesn't sound like something that you would want to be on the bad end of.
No, it's actually just a spar that dangles off the bowsprit. You know, that's the thing. I mean, if I was to write this in English nautical language, again, people really wouldn't know. So if they don't know that language, then why not know it in Laskari? Because they wouldn't know it in English anyway.
Amitav Ghosh is the author of many novels, including most recently, Sea of Poppies.